Good to see everybody out tonight. Good to see the hearty souls. We're going to continue tonight the series that we began a couple of weeks ago on impassioned Christianity. And I'll just tell you, I'm doing this not only for your benefit, but I'm going to be preaching a gospel meeting in New Caney, Texas, just above Houston, in several weeks, and this is the subject that I chose to preach in that meeting. And so you're my guinea pigs on this, as it were, and I hope that you are enjoying and benefiting from the things that we are talking about. But tonight, we're going to talk about impassioned soldiers, and that is what we are to be. The Bible tells us over and over and over again, the New Testament reminds us, that we are at war. We are not resting on our laurels. We are not living at, we are living at peace with God. We're living at peace with one another. But we are not at peace with this world, and we are certainly not at peace with the ruler of this world. The ruler of this world is seeking to destroy us. And it is our duty to do battle with him. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12, the Apostle Paul instructed Timothy to fight the good fight of faith. And that is an instruction for us as well. Jude chapter 2, Jude encourages his readers to contend earnestly for the faith. Both of those are battle terms, military terms. And we need to constantly remember that. It is our constant challenge to remember that in a world that sometimes seems pretty friendly to us, we are at war. We are at war against those things that are seeking to destroy us, to destroy the souls of all men, who are seeking to drag us or draw us away from God. And that war is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, 52 weeks out of the year war. But it is not unusual for us to forget that. I'm constantly having to remember that I am not just a Christian, I am a soldier in the army of God who has a responsibility to stand up against those things that are against God and that will threaten to destroy me. And so that is true for all of us. And so how do we go about remembering that? What are the secrets to remembering that? We'll talk about that in just a moment. But the first thing I want to do is talk about what it is that can cause us to forget that we are in a battle, that we're at war, that we are soldiers of God. And I want to do that by going back to the Old Testament, to three passages. The children of Israel were constantly finding themselves in a situation where they would forget who they were and the distinction that they had from the rest of the world. They constantly forgot that they were the people of God, they were the army of God, and that the surrounding world, under its pagan systems, which really was under the control of Satan himself, that that was the enemy. It was God's enemy, and it was their enemy, and seeking to destroy them. And at those times when they forgot that, they got themselves in serious trouble. And so we're going to look to begin our sermon tonight at those three areas, what it was that would cause or at least tempt Israel to forget that they are soldiers in the army of God and they have a responsibility to be at war with those things that are against the God and against His will and were against Him. The first ingredient of for lost militancy is a generation of God's people rise up who do not know the Lord or the work that He has done for His people. Go over to Judges chapter 2. In Judges chapter 2, the children of Israel have come to the end of the conquest of the promised land, and they have begun to settle into those areas that they had conquered. And the generation that had done the battles, the generation that had experienced the fact that God was with them, all back there in the wilderness, and then as they worked their way through this land, conquering this land, that generation was beginning to pass away, and it was being replaced by another generation, their children, the second generation of those who had come into the promised land. And notice what it said. Verse 8 says that Joshua, who was the great leader, the one who followed after Moses in the leadership of Israel, he is among those who pass away. And then in verse 10, it says, and this is Judges chapter 2, and verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. This is a group of people who had basically been born in the land that they were living in. And they had not had to battle the people who lived in that land. They had not had to conquer this land. They had not had opportunity to see God work as they went about conquering the land, to see God's power as he fought their battles for them and helped them to win those battles. They had seen none of those great works that had been done. They may have heard about some of those things, but they had not seen those things. They were, if you will, the second generation of God's people in the promised land. And it says they did not know the Lord. That word know is not that they didn't know who the Lord was. It is that they did not have that intimate relationship with the Lord. It's the same word that's way back in Genesis chapter 4 when Adam knew his wife. That is, he had intimate relationship with her. And in such the same way, God's people did not know him. They did not have an intimate family relationship with him. I know my father. Now, you know who my father is. You know Richard King in a certain sense. But I'll tell you, because he's my father and I have that relationship with him, I know him in a more intimate sense than you do. And that's the sense in which the word know is found here. This generation rose up who really, they knew that there was a Jehovah. But they did not know him in the sense that they did not have that intimate relationship with him. And they did not have that intimate relationship with the works that he had done. They didn't understand his power. And the less we know God and his work, the less committed we will be to God and his work. And that's especially true in the area of spiritual warfare. I'll tell you, there's a danger among second and third and fourth generation Christians, which most of us are. Our parents and possibly our grandparents were Christians. The danger for us is that we're born physically into what we are doing here, but we really we perhaps did not appreciate the fact that we were born again into this. That is, we didn't have to fight the same fights. We didn't have to give up the same things that the first generation Christians had to give up. We didn't have to turn our back on our families. We didn't have to turn our back on friends in order to obey the gospel of Christ. I'll tell you, second and third generation Christians have wonderful privileges. They've had wonderful opportunities in their life. I'm at least a third generation Christian, possibly a fourth, on my mother's side, and I grew up in the Lord's church. I went to Bible classes way back there when. And I grew up on all of those stories, those Old Testament stories of the people of faith. I grew up on New Testament principles. I understood those things. And that's a wonderful privilege that second and third and fourth generation Christians have. They're in this from very early on. And that's a wonderful opportunity to know. You're not baptized and then you kind of learn these basic things. You already know the basic things. But I'll tell you, while there's that wonderful opportunity for second and third and fourth generation Christians, there's also a great danger. And the great danger is that we were never called upon to make that kind of sacrificial obedience to the will of God. We were never called upon to say no to close friendships, to say no to close family members, to turn our back on things that we had been familiar with all of our lives in order to obey the gospel of Christ. There's a great danger in that. There's the danger that while we may become extremely knowledgeable about the facts of God and His work, we may never have made that kind of turn our backs on the world decision that those who are first generation Christians had to make. And when that is the case, there is the possibility that if we ever had a sense of militancy, it's easy for us to lose it. That's the first ingredient for lost militancy. A generation rises up that doesn't know the Lord. There's a second, though. The second ingredient for lost militancy that the children of Israel had to deal with was that half of us learned the language of Ashdod. Go over to Nehemiah chapter 13. Nehemiah chapter 13, the children of Israel have returned from Babylonian captivity. In Ezra's time, they had rebuilt the temple. In Nehemiah's time, they had rebuilt the wall. And Nehemiah had overseen their rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. And then he's gone away for a period of time. And when he returns in Nehemiah chapter 13, he finds that things have fallen apart. The temple has fallen into a state of disrepair, of pollution. There are Gentiles living in the temple. He finds that the Sabbath day is not being honored as God wanted it to be honored. He learns that people are treading the wine presses on the Sabbath day. And then, in verse 23, he sees Jews who had married into the surrounding Gentile nations. He said, in those days I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. The significance of that is that these were women who come from a pagan background. They worshipped idols. They did not honor and serve Jehovah God. And so here is a child of God who marries someone who is a child of Baal or a child of some other pagan religion. They marry, and the result of that, it says in verse 24, half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. Ashdod was one of the principal cities of the Philistines, And the Ashdodites were part of a nation who never honored God, who never served God, who was steeped in paganism. In fact, most of the time they were at odds with the children of Israel. They were one of Israel's greatest enemies. Thus, the language of Ashdod was a language that the Jews had no business learning. The fact that half of the Jewish children spoke the language of Ashdod is an indication that the children of Israel had compromised with the world. What does it mean for us to speak the language of Ashdod in our day and time? What is the language of Ashdod for us? I want to suggest to you that when the world's music becomes our music, when what the world likes to listen to that is indecent and immoral, when that becomes the things that we like to listen to, we have learned the language of Ashdod. When the world's entertainment that is sensual, an entertainment that is vulgar, when that becomes our entertainment, we have learned the language of Ashdod. When the world's definition of decency in speech and in dress and in action, when that becomes our definitions of decency, we have learned the language of Ashdod. And I'll tell you, when you learn the language of Ashdod, you forget the language of God. It is difficult for you to speak Ashdod and at the same time speak the language of God. And I want you to see that there in this passage. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah. That's God's language. They had learned the world's language, and so they were unable to speak the language of God. And so it is today. When God's people learn to speak the world's language, their ability to speak God's language is going to suffer dramatically. You're going to have a hard time speaking Bible if you have learned to speak world. I want you to see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 is kind of hearkening back to the things that we talked about this morning in our sermon, this inability of people that we saw from Hebrews chapters 5 and 6, the inability of the people to whom the Hebrew writer wrote to understand the things that that the Hebrew writer wanted to give to them. And now here we have Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 really saying the same kind of thing. They have an inability to understand the things that Paul is writing to them. And listen to it. He says in 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 1, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual people, but as to carnal, as to babes in Christ. I fed you with milk and not solid food, for until now you were not able to receive it, and even now you are still not able, for you are still carnal. For where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men?" Here are people who had learned the language of the world. They had learned the language of envy. They had learned the language of strife. They had learned the language of ill repute. Because of that, they couldn't understand the language of God. Paul said, there's things that I want to give you, but I can't give them to you. You can't understand them. And the reason you can't understand them is you've learned the language of the world. You want to know why folks in the church have difficulty grasping the teaching of Christ and His apostles? Oftentimes it is because they have learned another language. They've learned the language of the world. And then there's a third reason why the Israelites lost their sense of militancy, and that was easy living. They had come at times to live an easy life. When you go over to the book of Amos, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, and Amos, when you come to the book of Amos. In chapter 6, in verse 1, Amos is writing to a people who are definitely not passionate about God. They're definitely not passionate about being the children of God and following the will of God. Why is that? Well, he gives us a clue to it in chapter 6 and verse 1 when he says, "Woe to you who are at ease in Zion." These people had become easy livers. They were living there in Jerusalem, and they had the finest of things. And their finest of things was getting in the way of their understanding of who they were and what their responsibility was. They had surrounded themselves with the finest things of the world, and that had caused them to lose sight of the fact that they were to be a people who were spiritually apart from this world. See it in verse 4. He talks about, let's start at verse 3. "Woe to you who put far off the day of doom, who cause the seed of violence to come near." So they're in trouble, is what Amos says to him. Why is that? Well, here's your clue. Verse 4. "Who lie on beds of ivory, stretch out on your couches, eat lambs from the flock, and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idly to the sound of stringed instruments, and invent for yourself musical instruments like David, who drink wine from bowls and anoint yourselves with the best ointments." Luxurious living. They had become a physically soft people because of the things that they had, and that had led them into this kind of spiritual softness. He said they had all of these things. They were lying on beds of ivory. They drank their wine not out of cups but out of bowls. Why? Get more in there. They had everything that they wanted. Everything was taken care of. And the result of that was, in the last part of verse 6, they had an inability to be grieved at what he calls the affliction of Joseph. I believe the affliction of Joseph is their spiritual condition. They couldn't grieve over the fact that they were unrighteous. They couldn't grieve over the fact that they were in danger of losing their relationship with God. In fact, had pretty much already lost their relationship with God. And they were in danger of being overthrown, of the beds of ivory and the bowls being taken away. They couldn't grieve over their spiritual condition because they had become so lazy, so complacent in their physical condition. Go over to Proverbs chapter 30. In Proverbs chapter 30, Agur, the writer of this passage, makes two requests from God in beginning at verse 7. He says, "Two things I request of you, deprive me not before I die. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. Neither give me poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted to me." Did you notice that second request? "Give me neither poverty nor riches." Tell you, I prayed that first one before. "Lord, don't let me be poor." I don't recall ever saying, "Lord, don't let me be rich." You? It says, don't give me poverty. Don't let me be poor, but guard me against being rich too. Why is that, Agur? Verse 9, "Lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord?" You see, Agur understood the danger there. Our Agur and Amos, are they saying that having things is a sin? Having a lot of things, having prosperity is a sin? Certainly not. Are they saying that with those many things, comes a great danger? Absolutely, they are. Are they saying that with a soft couch and good food and good music come a temptation to lose your grief over the spiritual condition that you see all around you? Absolutely, they are. So what is the church today? Well, in most places, it is a group of second and third generation Christians who have become fluent in the language of the world that is around them and who have become creatures who enjoy the best of physical comforts that the world has to offer. And then we're shocked when we lose our militancy against the world. It's a wonder that we ever keep it, isn't it? With all of those things that we think are blessings, and they are to a certain extent, but they are also strikes against us in remembering who we are and that we are enlisted in the army of God, to wonder if there's any militancy left in us. And so the question becomes, if we lose our sense of militancy, we lose that passion as the soldiers of God, how do we get that back? First of all, I want to go to 2 Corinthians 10. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, I think we find a number of ingredients that'll help us to guard ourselves. If we've lost our militancy, to get that militancy back. And if we struggle with it, it'll help us to strengthen ourselves in the memory of what we are. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, I want to begin reading at verse 3. He says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for the pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Several things in this. First of all, we need to get more spiritually fit. And that, I think, is what he is saying there in verse 4 about becoming mighty, in armoring up and becoming mighty in the things of God so that we can fight that warfare. Of course, the quintessential passage on that is Ephesians 6. Verses 13 through 17, is it not? About putting on the whole armor of God and equipping ourselves so that we can stand. We take up the whole armor of God. We gird our waist with truth. We put on the breastplate of righteousness. We shod our feet with the preparation of the gospel. We take the shield of faith. We take the helmet of salvation. We take the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And I'll tell you, Paul is not writing there to non-Christians, telling them how to become Christians. He is writing there to Christians who are in danger of forgetting the fact that they are at odds with the world. They are at war with this world. And they need to equip themselves so that they can do battle with this world and the forces that rule this world. He says our battle is not against flesh and blood, and that doesn't mean it's not a real battle, because it's as real as the battle gets. Battles that involve flesh and blood enemies are battles that end when this life is over. They're battles that have their result in this life. But the battle that Paul is writing about in Ephesians chapter 6 is a battle that has eternal consequences involved in it. You know, it's hard to get comfortable when you're wearing armor head to toe. It's hard to lie on beds of ivory and stretch out on couches when we are fully armored. And I would ask, have we become an army who has shed its armor so that we can get comfortable on those beds of ivory? If so, then Paul says there in Ephesians 6 that we need to get up and we need to suit up. Secondly, we need to identify the enemy's strongholds. And he says there in verse 4, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, for mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. And doing what? And casting down arguments. We need to identify who the enemy is. And let me suggest to you that the enemy, first of all, is not your brethren. The enemy's not your brethren. The enemy is not the preacher. The enemy is not the elders. The enemy is not the Bible class teacher. The enemy is not your brother or your sister who is sitting across the aisle from you. The enemy is Satan and the forces of Satan. Brethren, we need to be pointing our swords and our arrows in the right direction. The strongholds of Satan are those places wherein Satan has amassed his army for an all-out assault against the people of God. There's a scholarly world out there that is denying the God who created the world and the Son of God who died for this world on the cross of Calvary. We need to be pointing our swords and our arrows at that ungodly, scholarly world. There's a humanistic world out there that is pushing an agenda of immorality with all the vigor that Satan can supply. We need to be pointing our swords and our arrows at that ungodly, humanistic thought. And there's a religious world out there that is scoffing at God's plan of salvation and His plan for the church. We need to be pointing our arrows and our swords at that ungodliness which the religious world is full. We need to remember who the enemy is. And when we recognize who he is, we need to go to battle with him. We need to fight the devil. He is the one who makes the arguments that need to be cast down. He is the one who exalts the high things that need to be tumbled down. He is the one who puts those thoughts into our minds that need to be taken captive. We need to fight the devil. You know, the devil wants to do battle. Peter said that he roams about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And that sounds awfully imposing. But James tells us we resist him and he'll flee from us. Peter says, resist him and be strong in your faith. But we have to resist him. And that involves action. I'll tell you, our Bible classes and our worship services, they're wonderful opportunities to kind of have these battle strategy sessions to learn things about how we can resist Satan. But we're not resisting Satan in here. We're not resisting Satan in the Bible class. We're learning how. We have to take that strategy outside these walls. The general will tell you that the battle that's never fought is the battle that can never be won. No army ever won a battle by sitting around in a room and just strategizing and never going out and putting the strategy to work. Let's get out there and let's fight the devil. And then let's see the fight all the way to the end. He uses the term every there, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Being ready to punish all disobedience when your disobedience is fulfilled. You see, fighting is weary stuff. It's tiring to fight battles. There's some awfully strong individuals who found it wearying to fight some battles. Elijah, we looked at him several weeks ago, and there in 1 Kings chapter 19, where he had just gotten off a great victory in the battle against Jezebel and her 450 prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel. And he didn't get the results that he wanted to get, and he just became weary. He became weary of the battle. He became weary of living. Remember what God told him to do? God said, get up. Get up and get back to work. I've got work for you to do. You know, Elijah thought he was all by himself. He thought he was the only one left that wanted to serve God. And God said, you need to know there are a number of people. That's 7,000, he said, who have not bowed the knee to Baal. The Apostle Paul, when he wrote to the Corinthians, told them that he was with them in weakness and in fear. But in Acts chapter 18, we find Paul in Corinth, and this is the time that I believe that he's talking about there in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3. And the Lord comes to him. And the Lord told him, don't fear. He didn't say, don't fear because there are 7,000 here in Corinth who've not bowed the knee to Baal and they're with you. He said, you don't fear because I am with you. God's promise is just as true today, and so is His charge. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. 2 Thessalonians 3. In verse 13, let's all fight the devil. Let's all fight him to the end. Let's all enjoy the victory together. The old warrior, Paul, preparing for the final assault from Satan's forces, wrote this to the young preacher, Timothy. He said, but you be watchful in all things. Endure afflictions. Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering. For the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord will give to me, and not to me only, but to all who have loved His appearing. That was Paul's challenge to Timothy, and it's his challenge to us as well. Who will follow Jesus standing for the right, holding up His banner in the thickest fight, listening to His orders, ready to obey? Who will follow Jesus serving Him today? Is that the determination that you've made in your life to be impassioned soldiers for Almighty God? Perhaps there's someone in our audience this evening who's not even begun the fight. They've not even enlisted in the army of God. If that's you, our encouragement to you is enlist. Do what Jesus said you need to do in order to become one of His disciples and one of God's soldiers in the army of God that is fighting the devil and the forces of the devil. And Jesus Christ will see to victory. He who believes will be and is baptized will be saved. That's Jesus' call to enlist. You want to answer it this evening? If you want to answer that call or any other call that the Lord has made for you to be faithful to Him, and we can help you to do that, let us know how we can by coming forward right now while together we stand and sing.